Florida Basketball Hour is brought to you by the Gataverse. Gataverse.io, GataVerse.io is an innovative approach to NIL. It connects fans, athletes, and merchants with digital and physical collectibles to verify community membership and grant access to exclusive privileges, VIP events, rewards, and experiences, and athletes receive a majority of the revenue from sales that are done by the Gataverse, which means that it's NIL the way it's supposed to happen, because the majority of the money goes right into the pockets of our student athletes. That's the way it's supposed to work. They sponsor Florida Basketball Hour. I'm a member. I love my membership. You will too. Join Gataverse today.
Hello and welcome to Florida Basketball Hour. This is not Neil Blackman. This is much like the Gators, the last couple of games having to play a couple people out of position. This is me, Eric Fawcett, playing a little out of position as host, as Neil is busy and unable to join us. But I have a very special guest. I don't remember how many times this has been for you, but I am very excited to welcome on Jacob Redner of 24/7 Sports, CBS, all that good stuff. Thank you for being here, Jacob.
Yeah, Eric, it's always a pleasure. I think this is like time number 5 or 6 off the top of my head.
Wow. Yeah, we are, you got that COVID year and you're into that extra eligibility coming in a 5th or 6th time. We appreciate that. And I will be honest, I also asked Jacob to come on the podcast, and I did not realize that it was going to be when the football transfer portal opened. So Jacob is making time for us, and I really appreciate that. So we'll get into some questions here and get you back to all that important football stuff that that I know that you'll be busy with tonight. But I jokingly refer to you. Not jokingly, I mean, I'm pretty serious about it. You're kind of the like Woj or the Shams of Florida basketball. Like if there's a scoop, like it's coming from Jacob. So I say that, you know, both to be complimentary and also just to say like you are as connected as anyone, and you're the one who kind of has the feel of what's going on in the locker room around the team. And I'm just curious, like, what are the kind of general vibes of this year's team as opposed to last year's team?
Yeah, well, first of all, I appreciate that. Second of all, I would say that, you know, it's kind of a complete overhaul, which is what we expected before the season. And I believe I was even on the show sometime during the preseason, if I remember correctly, and you and I talked about just, you know, it's a completely different roster. You have 9 newcomers. Todd Golden said it's the most he's ever had in his career. And I think that that's reflected in its energy and the character of the team. I think it's a completely different group. There's a lot more cohesion relative to what they had last year. And I think that that's been of benefit to them in the early going of the season. But just generally speaking, they have a lot of new faces in the building, and getting those guys to connect both on and off the court, I think, has been a little more seamless relative to what it was last year, where guys like, you know, Todd Golden and his coaching staff are coming in and you're inheriting a lot of players. And it's kind of a blend of cultures from a previous coaching staff and, you know, the cultures of the guys that you're going to bring in. And there are challenges that are associated with that. And we saw those kind of play out. Whereas this year, I think that there's just been a lot more of a smooth lead up to the season as a result of an improved culture. And so far, you know, through just a handful of games here, I would say that we've seen that.
Yeah, that was what I was going to get into. I remember us talking a little bit in the preseason about how the staff wanted to attack a certain kind of player. They wanted some guys that were a lot more comfortable making plays. Usage is the term that the staff used. Obviously, we are... like the season still feels so early, so we don't want to make any sweeping judgments, but like, how do you think the early returns are on some of these changes the coaching staff has made from lessons that they learned in year one?
Well, I think it's fair to say that it looks really positive. And of course, I think, you know, to reiterate what you just said, it is super early. And so, you know, I don't really have any grand takeaways at this point, but I will tell you this. I think that this is a much more encouraging group. I think that there's a lot more promise that these guys play with, and that is a byproduct of the players who they brought in. I think Zion Pullen, in just really a very short sampling of games due to that suspension he served to start the season, has really shown his, you know, capability to guide this team and to be kind of the point guard figure that I think that they were missing to a degree last year. a guy who really can facilitate, and that's been super helpful. Walter Clayton, we've seen when he's at his best, it can be really truly unstoppable as a scorer and as a versatile kind of guy. And then, of course, in the front court, I think they did their best work. You bring in a guy like Micah Hanlogton, who's been fantastic when healthy, serving the role exactly, you know, as they kind of needed, as that big rim protector and rebounder, but also somebody who's a sure-handed scorer, especially from close range. And then, you know, really impressed by Tyrese Samuel, who's done kind of a little bit of everything and had a couple historic performances in the early going. So the returns are positive. Do I think that there needs to be more consistency from that group? I think everybody would tell you that at this point, but there's a long way to go and a lot of time to figure that out.
So you mentioned Hanlogton. A lot of people are very much clamoring for his for him to get back. There's been lots of conversation about, like, do the Gators have one more win than they currently do if he's healthy? It's obviously impossible to say, but we're recording Monday night. What are you hearing kind of recently about his status?
Yeah, well, I would just say this, that, you know, Florida's going to be careful in terms of how quickly it brings him back. He's 7'1", and you don't really want to put too much pressure on an ankle injury, especially too quickly. And if you don't have to, you're going to lean towards sitting him out. I don't know that there's been a call made, you know, for Florida's Tuesday game against Merrimack, depending on when you're listening to this. I would still lean towards him being doubtful or closer to out for that, just because, you know, I'm not so sure Florida needs him for that kind of a contest. I think that it's pretty safe to say that they should be able to get Bass, you know, KenPom 284 team without Micah Hanlogton. But I would say that there's a very good chance that he's available by the weekend when Florida plays Richmond.
Yeah, and that was going to be always kind of interesting with this with Florida last playing Wednesday on the 29th and playing this game with Merrimack, who is quite undersized. They play a lot of 2-3 zone. I'll talk a little bit about that later. And then you've got a plucky Richmond team that Richmond with a little bit of a reputation for giving high major teams struggles. And that's not a loss that Florida can really afford to get. So you'd love to see maybe him get back for that one, even if it's not at full capacity. And then, of course, the Gators have their last high major non-conference opponent coming up December 19th with Michigan. So, so that's going to be pretty interesting. The last two games that Micah Hanlogton missed was Baylor and Wake Forest. Two games that the Gators, I'll say, let slip in one. You could make an argument that they let slip in both games. But, I'm just this is kind of the first real adversity, I would say, that the Gators have faced, with two losses that I think they were pretty frustrated by for different reasons. What were kind of your takeaways from those two games?
Yeah, I think that the both of them came with positives and negatives. And I would start with the Baylor game and just saying that I think it was good to see Florida keep pace in that one. I think that there were a lot of people who were going into that game wondering, is Florida of the caliber team that's going to be able to compete in this kind of a contest? And I think that they answered that question. Did both games bring up some concerns, like how Florida defends the three-point line, or offensive turnovers proving problematic? Those kinds of things did rear their heads. Defensive rebounding is another one. I think that for me, those early games were relatively more positive than they were negative, in that I think that it's clear that Florida has assembled an improved team. It's a lot more well-rounded. I think that they're capable of doing a lot of the things that they struggled with last year. Offensive rebounding is one of them. You know, three-point shooting is really one of them. I think we've seen Riley Kugel kind of start to emerge in these last couple games, even though they haven't necessarily, Florida being, you know, ending up on the right side of the scoreboard. And so for those reasons, I was encouraged. Do I think that there's a lot of areas to improve and, you know, grow in terms of consistency and being able to kind of spread out that good play across every facet they need to really click on all cylinders? Yeah, of course. But I would also tell you this, you know, Florida's only played one full complete game as a team this season, and that was against Florida State. And I know you didn't ask about that, but that was an excellent showing in that game. I mean, they win that game by 20 points. You're up by 30 at halftime. And that was a complete performance with a complete team. So, you know, what these last couple games have really done for me, Eric, is I think that I leave them going, I want to see what this looks like for a couple games in a row, healthy and complete, before I really draw any judgment. But yes, there are areas where I would say are really strong with this group that are apparent, and also some that, you know, obviously need to improve.
So you mentioned earlier that this just seems to be a little bit more, I forget exactly how you phrase it, but there's just a lot more like encouraging about this team. And something that just shocked me was in Florida's second game of the season, they lose to Virginia in, again, you could probably say somewhat frustrating fashion. I think the Gators would love to have some of those final minutes back. And it just kind of struck me that over the last like 5 years, fans would be furious. And maybe that's a game in the last 5 years, Florida doesn't lose 73-70. They lose like 60-58. And fans are just left thinking like, man, like it's such a slog offensively. Oh, I don't know if this team plays as hard as I think they should. And like, I was stunned at the positivity, at least like, you know, on Twitter and the Gator Country boards. And again, even after tough losses to Baylor and Wake Forest, like, yeah, there's frustration, but it seems like just the general like fan enthusiasm about this team is much, much higher. And I'm just curious, is that something that you're seeing? I mean, it's always funny to see the differences between like different message boards. So I'm talking Gator Country. You've of course got the 24/7 boards that are extremely active. Like, are you seeing a lot more positivity despite these bad losses? And what does that tell you about how like style of play matters, maybe particularly when you're at a football school?
Well, you know, I absolutely would agree with that. I think that we have seen a lot more positivity, and I think for good reason. It's for the reasons that we just discussed, and it's that this is a clearly improved group. I think that there's some proof of concept that's occurred even through seven games in terms of this staff's ability to identify talent in the transfer portal and assemble a roster quickly, and that matters. And so, you know, just by that alone, is the positivity warranted? I think so. And to answer your question just about style of play, it's everything, especially if you aren't going to win every single game. I mean, you're 4-3 and people are positive for a reason. And that's because I think it's easier to identify this year that there are positives on the court. The way that this team is more organized, the way that this team, I think, moves the ball is a great way. You know, you can an easy way to compare this team to last year's team and you know, assess strengths and weakness or areas of improvement. You can look at the ball movement. You know, I've talked to several people who would point to that and say, you know, the organization of that and the way that they are more cohesive relative to what we saw last year is an obvious sign of where that they've improved. And they're playing at a faster pace too. So to be able to do both of those things at the same time, I think speaks volumes just to the direction of the program and where they're headed. But of course, you know, I also want to couch that by saying this, there are still areas to improve also. And so I think to somebody who would watch this team and go, I'm still waiting to see, and it's too early for me to really know, I think that's fair too. But I would say that, yeah, I would agree with you. You know, it's generally more positive than it has been negative.
Yeah, happy to see that the 24/7 boards are similar to the Gator Country boards in that sense. Just to also just use some numbers to back up what you were just talking about. So last year, the Gators were 224th in the country in assists or assist percentage. More accurately, and this year they're 88th, so a huge improvement there. And of course, Todd Golden wanted to play fast. Limitations last year kept him from doing so. Last year the Gators were 146th in the country in offensive possession length, and this year they are 11th in average possession length. So you're definitely seeing that increased pace, and I think talking like it's definitely just watching the team eye test wise, you're seeing so much ball movement, but at the same time, the numbers are backing that up. And it's also, it's not like it's, you know, this was before you started covering the Gators, but like there was times where Florida's assist numbers were good several years back, but it was because Andrew Nembhard had 9 assists and it kind of like propped up the team when you're like, oh, there's actually only one guy who's really making plays. And, but this, you know, you can look and see multiple players. While I'm talking numbers, you mentioned defensive rebounding. And I just wanted to get your take on this because this is I'll call it a crazy stat. I mean, again, this is early. It's kind of small sample size theater, 7 games into the season. But the Gators are 5th in the country in offensive rebounding, and they're 220th in defensive rebounding. So I'm just curious, like, do you think that the poor defensive rebounding is somewhat of, you know, it's anomaly, just small sample size, or, you know, how do you kind of reconcile, oh, this is a team that's pounding the offensive glass, but they're not doing very well on the defensive glass?
Yeah, I think both numbers stand a chance to kind of come back to earth, if you will. You know, I think Florida is really improved in its ability to rebound. And I think that we've seen that on the offensive end in a way that I don't know is going to be sustained throughout the entire season, being 5th in the country. But we've also seen them struggle on the defensive glass in a way that I don't think is going to be sustained for the remainder of the season. I can see both numbers kind of being very solid by the time everything is said and done here, but maybe not like, you know, among the best and among the worst. And I, honestly, it does feel fluky to me. I don't really have any other way to explain it. It doesn't seem like an effort issue because you don't get to number five in the country on the offensive end due to a lack of effort. And I don't think that it shuts off, you know, on one end versus the other of the court. And so to me, yeah, I would say that it is fluky. They have faced some really great offensive rebounding teams so far this season. And obviously that's showing up in their poor defensive rebounding numbers. Blocked shots also kind of contributes to that because that's going to go down as an offensive rebound when you hit it out of bounds. And so that to a degree can be a little bit misleading, but I think generally speaking, we'll see some narrowing from where they are offensively versus where they are defensively as time goes on here, we get a little deeper into the season.
So let's talk small sample size theater once more. Another number that surprises me a little bit, and again, it is early, but we know that Todd Golden and his staff love analytics. We know what they did at San Francisco, and we know anyone that is particularly analytically savvy is going to want to get a lot of three-point attempts up. So the Gators right now are 254th in the country in three-point attempts. And their three-point percentage, which is like I think a lot of people think is like horrendous because they have had a couple of rough shooting games, like they're 179th in the country. So despite a couple of rough shooting games, they have shot a manageable percentage. But that's another one I'll just ask you, Noel, while we're talking about, you know, what's for real and what's going to maybe normalize to something else. What do you think about 254th in the country in three-point attempts right now? And I'll also point out the last year, and again, there were limitations of that roster, but last year the Gators were 200th in the country in three-point attempts. So, you know, that was another team that was well below average in that category.
Yeah, they are scoring 53.7% of their points from two-point range, and I actually think that one thing that has maybe surprised me a little bit has been their success at scoring from the paint. We can even go back into the preseason scrimmages that they did, one against Miami, which I think is relatively meaningful, and they scored, I think off the top of my head, it was like more than 50% of their points in the paint. And so there might not be a reason to kind of stray from that. If it's working, let it continue to work. Tyrese Samuel has proven extremely effective. We've seen guys like Zion Pullen be able to take the ball to the basket and kind of play downhill at 6'4" and built like a middle linebacker. And so those things are working for Florida. I don't know that it's going to stray from that while that's happening. Do I think that we're going to see, again, kind of like the rebounding things balance out, or at least in the direction that Florida intends as the season goes on? Yeah, I think so. But look, if they're going to be as successful as they've been at getting to the basket and scoring points that way, I can see that kind of becoming an unexpected identity of this team, where it doesn't have to rely on the three-point ball to be able to put up a ton of points and to keep up with your higher scoring teams in the country, which I think Florida is right now.
Yeah. And I think even when you add in, like talking about scoring in the paint, it's easy to look at some of the size in the front court, but it's like Zion Pullen has a lot of those. When you look back at UC Riverside, he has a lot of those, like, not as many layups, but he's got those like get into the paint, reverse pivot and shoot a little fadeaway jump shot from 12 feet out, which are like still paint points in a different way. And Walter Clayton is someone who also shows a little bit of that physicality as a downhill driver. So I will be interested to see if Florida kind of continues down their current path, or if the 3-point shots really increase, because again, that would be most, you know, quote unquote analytics people's way of going about things. I didn't think this was going to just turn into me just asking you about a whole bunch of stats, but here we are. And there was one very important stat that came up today. And that was the net ranking, because this was the first day that the net ranking came out. And I think a lot of people were surprised because, and eventually KenPom and the net will become very similar. But, you know, right now the Gators are 35th in KenPom, but they came in at 65th in the net. Again, it's early. There are plenty of opportunities to boost that number. But something else that also just like struck me and Jacob, I just have to fill you in. This was a bit of a debate between me and Neil when Florida announced their non-conference schedule. Neil suggested that it was quite a challenging non-conference schedule, and I said, no, I don't think it's that challenging. You know, we can look at the numbers to back that up, but one of the things that jumps out right now about about the net is the Gators only had two quadrant one games, and they're 0-2 in those games. And they probably, or they may not have another quad one game. Michigan is one that they might have thought was going to be a quadrant one game, but they're currently 89th in the net, and they would need to get up to 50 because that'll be a neutral site game. I guess my question for you, like, because, you know, Neil and I were arguing because he thought it was a challenging schedule, and I said, no, I don't think it's a particularly challenging non-conference schedule. But I was also quick to say, like, maybe Florida didn't want it to be that challenging because they were going to have plenty of opportunities in the non-conference schedule. Do you think that Florida, like, where do you land on the scheduling? Do you think that Florida knew that it was not going to be a particularly challenging non-conference where they might only get two quadrant one games? Or do you think that they got kind of, you know, done dirty a little bit by Florida State and Pittsburgh and Wake Forest and Michigan not being as good as they maybe expected?
I would tend to lean towards the latter. I mean, KenPom still assesses Florida's overall schedule to be 33rd most difficult in the country. That is, you know, at least in part due to their non-conference schedule. Are there a couple games that I think are maybe a little easier than they were anticipated? Yeah, I would say that that's closer to the reality, I think. But this is a challenging schedule, I think. And I am surprised, just to go back to what you were talking about a second ago, I am a little surprised by the initial net ranking. I do also think that that will narrow in terms of the gap between that and a KenPom, where Florida's in the mid-30s going into its, you know, game against Merrimack. So, I actually would lean towards this being a more challenging schedule in theory that kind of developed in a way that maybe wasn't foreseen.
Yeah, and I think, too, when you look at, like, talking about gaming the net, which I know it can't really be gamed, but it seems to be pretty clear that the way to, if there is a way to game the net, it's by just absolutely blowing out blowing out, like, by game opponents and just boosting that efficiency number. One team that has done it, you know, really well is Iowa State. I think that they were 12th in the net, even though they're much lower on every other metric. And it was because, and, you know, they beat, like, Grambling by like 60 points, who the Gators are going to play. And they beat Lindenwood by like 60 points and Green Bay by like 40. And, you know, maybe that's the way Florida looks to schedule in the future, which is going to be unfortunate for a lot of ways, but you're seeing teams that are getting rewarded for just blasting horrible bye games. And it is working for teams like Iowa State, but we will see again. Florida will get plenty of opportunities in the SEC to put up quadrant one games. But I am guessing that Florida thought they might get more than two or possibly three here in the non-conference. But Jacob, I know you are busy. I know you have probably football transfer portal stuff to get to. So at this point, you've been on the show so many times, and anyone that's going to be following this show is probably very well aware of your work, but still, please plug everything you do and let people know where they can find you.
Well, first of all, let me just say this, and it's always a pleasure, you know, coming on the show and being able to talk to your guys' audience. You do such a great job. Yes, if you are looking for my basketball content, you can find that over at swamp247.com. As Eric said at the beginning of the show, we're constantly talking Florida basketball with insider information and all that good stuff and keeping people in the loop. And if you want just the Twitter experience, that's at Jacob Rudner. So those are my places right now.
That is awesome. Thank you so much, Jacob.
Appreciate it. Have a good one, Eric.
Bye now. So that was Jacob Rudner. I'm always thankful for him coming on. And again, I did not realize that I asked him on during like the absolute pinnacle of the football transfer portal season. So I really am thankful for him giving the time. I really do think he does just fantastic work. And I kind of think he's someone that like you have to follow if you like Florida basketball, because he is someone, whether it's recruits, whether it's injury news, whether it's, you know, when it was the portal season, like Jacob is first on most things. So we love Jacob. We love that he could join us. I just wanted to talk a little bit more before we close out the show. And I think it's going to start with something that I wrote at Gator Country, and something that I also did a video on Patreon. But it's kind of regarding Florida's offense and kind of how, I'll say, bizarre it is analytically at the moment. And I mean that just in the sense of like right now, Florida is 24th in the country in adjusted offensive efficiency. Actually, if you look at Bart Torvik and you look at kind of pure performance with no preseason priors baked in, the Gators are 19th. And that's coming off a game against Wake Forest where they were not very good offensively, which we'll talk a little bit more about. So it's kind of one of those things where, you know, I watch Florida's offense and I think that it's not great. And I think that they struggle particularly with their first shot offense. But you see at the same time, they're putting up big point totals and they're doing it efficiently. And really that is largely because of the offensive rebound. The fact that they are fifth in the country in offensive rebounding. And this is after a game with Wake Forest where they didn't offensively rebound the ball very well. They were second going into that game. And it's just really interesting because it's one of those things that, like, if I was to argue with someone and I said, hey, I don't think Florida's offense is very good. And they wanted to say like, hey, Eric, you understand analytics, you understand points per possession. Objectively, the Gators are scoring efficiently. And I wouldn't really be able to argue that. But at the same time, I kind of wrote at Gator Country about the fact that, and I'll say the number here, but Florida's first shot offense has not been very good. And when you look at their kind of raw points per possession, which is, again, usually want to adjust for quality of competition, but I think it's interesting to see that the Gators are 139th in the country in points per possession. And in terms of half court efficiency, they're 169th. So it's interesting because I don't think that the Gators are doing a great job of generating quality shots. And therefore I would say that their offense is not great, but it doesn't matter if they're going to keep offensive rebounding like this. And I wrote about this as well, but it's reminding me a lot of Kentucky and Tennessee teams recently. And I think everyone who listens to this podcast will know every time it's time to preview a Tennessee game or a Kentucky game the last couple of years, we're kind of like, yeah, their offense doesn't look good. They really struggle to create shots. They struggle to hit shots, but they're like top 15 in adjusted offensive efficiency. And it's just that weird push and pull of like, okay, like they're struggling to get good shots, but if you just hammer teams on the offensive glass, you're still going to score efficiently. So where this is going to be an issue is a game like Wake Forest, where the Gators do not offensive rebound the ball very well. I think they had 7 offensive rebounds, which was like a 20% offensive rebound rate. And just as a reference, like when they're really cooking, like overall in the season, they're at 41%. It was like 20% against Wake Forest. And you kind of saw when the Gators didn't have all of those extra possessions, they really struggled to create shots. And I think their offense kind of struggled. So it's just something to monitor moving forward. And it's just kind of a funny conversation where some people might be listening to me say that Florida's offense isn't very good. And they'll say like, that's outrageous. You understand numbers. You understand efficiency. How can you say that the Gators offense isn't good? So, but again, I would just argue like, okay, like they have been productive, but it is largely because of the offensive rebound. And then the question after that would be like, well, okay, well, where does that leave them? And to me, when you study these teams that have offensive rebounded very well, but their first shot offense isn't very good, that seems to be a recipe for regular season success, but then also a recipe to go cold in the big games, largely in the NCAA tournament. Because you kind of when effort cranks up, you run into a scrappy team and you're not getting the same amount of offensive rebounds, suddenly you got to be able to create shots at first and not just when you can hammer the offensive glass. And, you know, I mentioned Tennessee and Kentucky teams. What have their reputation been in recent years? Oh, they can't win the big one. Oh, they can't win in March. So will that be the issue for the Gators if they're not able to, improve their first shot offense? Yeah, we'll have to find out. But at the same time, I think it's like, I'm not trying to say this just to be negative towards the Gators, because at the same time, because they've hammered the offensive glass, it also raises their floor quite significantly. Like, again, you look at the Gators last year, even in recent years where they're so bad on the glass and not great offensively. It was just like, well, you know, like how can they possibly muster points when they can't create shots and they can't hit tough shots and they're not getting extra possession? Like there's just, there's just no avenue to playing winning basketball offensively. And we have now seen with the Gators that it's like, hey, they could play awful offensively, but if they are going to rebound 41% of their misses, like, they're going to stay in games. So while I will use this as an opportunity to say that it is not good enough to be 169th in the country in half court points per possession, they still do deserve credit for this offensive rebounding. I don't want that. I don't want to take away from that. So it's something to monitor. I wrote more at length at Gator Country about that, and just kind of the things. I also did a Patreon video about just where the Gators are struggling, and again, just going through some of the film of Wake Forest. It just still seems like the Gators are a bit sloppy in going out of split cuts. Some of their actions, it just didn't seem like guys like Riley Trugel knew when to attack and when not. And, you know, Zion Pullen, who I think is fantastic with the ball in his hands, was not so good in some of the away from the ball actions. And because it's like he's someone who's had the ball in his hands for his whole collegiate career. So there's definitely things that can be improved. And also it's like, hey, Zion Pullen's been a true point guard his whole career, going to play off the ball a little bit more than he ever has here at Florida. He's probably going to improve there. So if you want to see that, you can, if you're a Patreon supporter, you can view that anytime you want. If you're not, you can join Patreon to see that video, as well as tons of other videos. We have missed a couple of games recently, just busyness around Thanksgiving. I was busy with a number of things, calling some university games here in Canada. And it's kind of unfortunate because those are big games with Baylor and Wake Forest. So we apologize, but want to just quickly touch on Merrimack. A really fun kind of team to schedule. I just love teams that like have a distinct style as college basketball continues to get more homogenized. Like one of the things I love about the sport is that there is such a variety of styles. And I do think the game is starting to get a little bit homogenized. So I always love when there's a team that plays like a super distinct style, and Merrimack plays pretty much, well, it's actually funny, going into this year, they played pretty much exclusively 2-3 zone. This year, they've actually started to play like 10% of their possessions in man, which is just kind of, to be quite frank, kind of strange to see tuning into a Merrimack game. And so I still think they're going to play mostly 2-3 zone, and it's going to give the Gators a chance to play a lot of zone that they haven't seen so far, because I don't know if the Gators have, trying to think if the Gators have played against, certainly not a team that plays all zone or a lot of zone, but they'll get the opportunity. We know that there's some teams in the SEC that will use 2-3. So this is a great chance to, see some 2-3 zone and get used to playing against that. Merrimack is led by Joe Gallo, their head coach. I think he is fantastic. I've watched so many of his coaching clinics on the 2-3 zone. I think he is fantastic. And Merrimack is just in their fifth year of Division I basketball after transitioning from Division II. And their story is kind of crazy because like they were like, so they joined in 2020, the Northeast Conference, and their first year they finished at the top of the NEC. They wouldn't have been eligible for the NCAA tournament because of the transition, even if there was one because of, but there obviously wasn't because of COVID. But like Merrimack, like as their first year in Division I, won the regular season of the NEC. And then if you go back to last year, this is just a story I think is kind of crazy. So everyone obviously knows Fairleigh Dickinson, and everyone knows that Fairleigh Dickinson beat Purdue. Well, in another world, Fairleigh Dickinson is not in that game at all, because Merrimack actually finished first in the regular season in the NEC. And then they played in the NEC conference tournament, and in the finals, they beat Fairleigh Dickinson. But because Merrimack was still in a transition phase, it was Fairleigh Dickinson, despite losing in the conference tournament or the conference finals, got to go to the NCAA tournament. And of course we know what happened. So it's just kind of interesting to see if, and everyone always talks about the transition rules. No one seems to like them, but if they didn't exist, and if there was a tournament during COVID, or that COVID year, I should say, Merrimack could have been to two out of two NCAA tournaments in 4 years, in their first 4 years coming from Division II. So I think that is fantastic. It speaks to what Joe Gallo has been able to do as a head coach. Unfortunately for them, as is the case for all good low major teams, they were kind of, I don't want to say gutted by the transfer portal, but they had two very important players. I believe Jordan Miner went to Virginia. The Gators saw him, and it's honestly seems like almost it hurts a little bit more where, like, you know, Jordan Miner, it's not like he's playing a ton for Virginia. He's playing like 7 minutes a game. It's not like he like it's one thing when players transfer up and play huge roles. Jordan Miner's at Virginia playing 7 minutes off the bench. And he was a 6'8 center. Played the middle of that 2-3 zone. Was so good at getting steals, so good at getting blocks, just like so intelligent in that zone. And then Ziggy Reed, 6'5", power forward, shoots the ball well, physical. He transferred to Youngstown State. So that was two players that were very valuable to Merrimack that left. So they really didn't return much, but Jordan Durkak is someone who did return. He has been very, very good, scoring over 15 points per game. He was someone who started, but, you know, was about, not scoring a ton, mostly like just like a 6'5" wing, again, bringing a little bit of length to the sides of that zone, but was not much of a scorer. And as a sophomore, he has taken on big time scoring roles, scoring over 15 points per game for Merrimack. And he's really interesting to watch because, like, oh man, he cannot shoot. Like, he is 3 for 21 from the 3-point line. And I think that's because he just hit a three in, went like 1 for 2 in their last game. Before that, he was, you know, shooting like 11% from three. So he really struggles to shoot, but still just finds a way to get into the lane. And just like to see a player like having to step up from being like a role player, defensive guy, to as a sophomore having to shoulder the offensive load, I think it's amazing. He's still so good at coming up with steals. He's 52nd in the country in steal percentage, and he's not even first on his team because Adam Clark is a 5'10" freshman, little guard, plays the top of that 2-3 zone, and he's 22nd in the country in steal percentage. So, like, overall, like, Merrimack is 12th in the country in steal percentage. They play that zone, like, they'll be aggressive out of it. I'll say they're very opportunistic. It's not like they're trapping a ton or anything like that, but they're just so smart in that 2-3 zone that they know when to shoot gaps, go for steals, and all that. So Merrimack's 4-5 on the season. They've played one high major opponent. It was Ohio State. They lost by 24. But they just had a very good win against UMass Lowell. UMass Lowell, you may have heard, they had a good start to the season beating the Fighting Kowasi Reeves and Georgia Tech, and then they almost beat Arizona State. So had a really solid start to their season, and Merrimack just beat them by 6. So that was a really good game for Merrimack. They got their offense going a little bit more. And I think entering that game, Merrimack was like 340 something in adjusted offensive efficiency. Now they're up to 329 after that stellar performance at UMass Lowell. But they just really struggle to score. Their zone is really solid. They again, it's just so well coached by Joe Gallo, but offensively things are just such a struggle for them. And it's just made even worse by the fact that they just cannot shoot. They're 322nd in the country in 3-point percentage and under 28%. And it's like their key players are the ones that like Adam Clark, the point guard, he's 0-for-8 on the season from three. So like, he just doesn't even want to take them. And Durkak is shooting 14% from three. So they've got some guys off the bench that are capable. One guy that shoots at like huge volume is Devon Savage. He's hitting 30. He's their one shooter the floor needs to be aware of. I think he has like over half of Merrimack's 3-point attempts. He's already taken 63 and hitting 22 of them, so which is 35%. But he's the one guy that shoots the ball well and at volume. Other than that, not so much. So I think it'll be an interesting game. I don't like. In other years, in previous years, I think Merrimack could have a team like Florida, maybe a little bit on upset alert. I don't think this is a team that could do that. They're young. They are very undersized. It's like 6'7", 190-pound centers. They do have a big 7-foot, 250-pounder off the bench, but he'll play like 10 minutes a game. So And again, it's going to be interesting. Like I just talked about how I didn't think Florida's offense has been great, particularly in the half court. And you'd love to see bye games as an opportunity to improve that. But it's one of those things that's like, you know, Florida's men offense has not been very good. Now they're about to play a team that just plays 2-3 zone. And hey, maybe Florida was a good zone team even last year. So maybe, maybe this is an opportunity to get some offensive rhythm going, some positivity. I think my one fear is that I think that Florida could win this game by 30 just offensive rebounding. Like Merrimack does not defensively rebound well. That's they're undersized. They play 2-3 zone. It's hard to rebound out of a 2-3 zone. That's one of the unfortunate parts about these teams that play a lot of it. So like Florida could just play horrible, hammer the offensive glass, get 25 offensive rebounds and win by 30. And that'd be great. But you'd love to see some crisp possessions. You'd love to see them knock down some shots. You'd love to see some offensive rhythm building. But this is recording Monday. Hopefully you have a chance to listen to this before Merrimack. And we thank you. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you to our Patreon supporters. Thank you to Gataverse for continuing to support us and allow us to make some great content. So go Gators and keep attacking closeouts.